Chapter 11. The following morning, Junie Black called him on the phone.
"Were you working?" she asked.
"I'm always working," Rakel said.
Junie said, "Well, I talked to Mr. Hemken, my attorney."
Her tone of voice informed him that she intended to go into the details.
"What a cumbersome business," she said, sighing.
"Let me know how it comes out," he said, wanting to get back to his puzzle-solving. But, as always, he was snared by her, involved in her elaborate histrionic problems.
"What did he say?"
he asked. After all, he had to take it seriously. If she took it to court, he might be hailed in as the co-respondent.
"Oh, Rakel," she said, "I want to see you so badly. I want to have you with me, close to me. This is such a grind."
"Tell me what he said."
"He said it all depends on how Bill feels. What a mess! When can I see you? I'm scared to come around your place. Margot gave me the worst look I've ever gotten from anybody in my life. Does she think I'm after you for your money, or what? Or is it just her naturally morbid mind?"
"Tell me what he said."
"I hate to talk to you over the phone. Why don't you drop over here for a while? Or would Margot be suspicious? You know, Rakel, I feel so much better now that I've decided. I can be myself with you, not held back artificially by doubts. This is the most important moment in my life, Rakel. It's really solemn, like a church. When I woke up this morning, I felt as if I had awakened in a church, and all around me was this sacred spirit. And I asked myself what the spirit was, and pretty soon I identified it as you."
She became silent then, waiting for him to contribute something.
"What about this civil defense business?" he said.
"What about it? I think it's a good idea."
"Are you going to be there?"
"No," she said. "What do you mean?"
"I thought that was the idea."
"Rakel," she said with exasperation, "you know, sometimes you're so mysterious, I just can't follow you."
He gathered at that point that he had made a mistake. Nothing remained but to drop the business about the civil defense classes. It was hopeless to try to explain to her what he meant and what he had thought when Mrs. Keitelbein approached him.
"Look, June," he said, "I want very much to see you, as much as you want to see me. More, very possibly. But I have this goddamn puzzle to finish."
"I know," she said. "You have your responsibility." She said it resignedly. "What about tonight, after you mail off your entry?"
"I'll try to call you," he said.
But her husband would be home, so nothing could come of it.
"Maybe later today," he said. "Late this afternoon. I think I can get my entry off early today."
He had had fair luck with it so far.
"No," she said. "I won't be home this afternoon. I'm having lunch with an old friend. A girlfriend. I'm sorry, Rakel. I've got so much I want to say to you and do with you. A whole lifetime ahead of us."
She talked on. He listened. At last, she said goodbye and he hung up, feeling let down. How hard it was to communicate with her. As he started back to his room, the phone rang again.
"Want me to get it?"
Margot called from the other room.
"No," he said. "It's probably for me."
He lifted the receiver, expecting to hear June's voice, but instead an unfamiliar older female voice said haltingly,
"Is Mr. Gum there?"
Speaking,
he said. His disappointment made him gruff.
"Oh, Mr. Gum, I wonder if you remembered the civil defense class. This is Mrs. Keitelbein."
"I remembered," he lied.
"Hello, Mrs. Keitelbein."
Making himself hard, he said,
"Mrs. Keitelbein, I'm sorry to have to—"
She interrupted.
"It's this afternoon. This is Tuesday, at 2 o'clock.
"I can't come," he said. "I'm bogged down in my contest work. Some other time."
"Oh, dear," she said. "But, Mr. Gum, I went ahead and told them all about you. They're expecting to hear you speak about World War II. I've phoned every one of them up, and they're all enthusiastic."
"I'm sorry," he said.
"This is a calamity,"
she said, plainly overcome.
Maybe you could come and not speak. If you could be at the class and just answer questions, I know that would please them so. Don't you think you could find time for that? Walter can drop by and pick you up in his car, and I know he can drive you back home afterward. The class is only about an hour at the longest, so it wouldn't be more than an hour and 15 minutes at the very most.
He doesn't have to give me a ride, Rachel said. You're only half a block away.
Oh, that's so, she said. You're just up the street from us. Then you surely ought to be able to make it. Please, Mr. Gum, as a favor to me?
Okay, he said.
It wasn't that important. An hour or so.
Thank you so much.
Her relief and gratitude flooded through her voice.
I really appreciate it.
After he had hung up, he got immediately to work on his entries. He had only a couple of hours to get them in the mail, and the sense that they had to be posted was, as always, dominant in him. At 2 o'clock, he climbed the flight of unpainted, sloping steps to the porch of the Keitelbein house and rang the bell. Opening the door, Mrs. Keitelbein said,
"Welcome, Mr. Gum."
Past her, he could see a shadowy collection of ladies in flowery dresses and a few ill-defined, thin-looking men. They all peered at him, and he understood that they had been standing around expecting him. Now the class could begin. Even here, he realized, my importance. But it brought him no satisfaction. The one person important to him was missing. His claim on Junie Black was slight indeed. Mrs. Keitelbein led him up beside her desk, the massive old wooden desk that he and Walter had lugged up from the basement. She had arranged a chair for him so that he would face the class.
Here, she said, pointing to the chair. You sit there.
For the class, she had dressed up. Her long silk robe-like skirt and blouse, with billows and lace, made him think of school graduations and musical recitals.
Okay, he said.
Before they ask you anything, she said, I think I'll discuss a few aspects of civil defense with them, just to get it out of the way.
She patted him on the arm. This is the first time we've had a celebrity at our meetings. Smiling, she seated herself at her desk and rapped for order. The indistinct ladies and gentlemen became quiet, the murmur stilled. They had seated themselves in the first rows of the folding chairs that Walter had set up. Walter himself had taken a chair in the back of the room, near the door. He wore a sweater, slacks, and necktie, and he nodded formally to Rachel.
I should have worn my coat, Rachel decided.
He had sauntered down in his shirt sleeves. Now he felt ill at ease.
At our last class, Mrs. Keitelbein said, folding her hands before her on the desk, somebody raised a question concerning the impossibility of our intercepting all the enemy missiles in the event of a full-scale surprise attack on America. That is quite true. We know that we could not possibly shoot down all the missiles. A percentage of them will get through. This is the dreadful truth, and we have to face it and deal with it accordingly.
The men and women, they responded as a body, images of one another, put on somber expressions.
If war should break out, Mrs. Keitelbein said, we would be faced, at best, with terrible ruin. Dead and dying in the tens of millions. Cities into rubble. Radioactive fallout. Contaminated crops. Germplasm of future generations irretrievably damaged. At best, we would have disaster on a scale never before seen on Earth. The funds appropriated by our government for defense, which seem such a burden and drain on us, would be a drop in the bucket compared with this catastrophe.
What she says is true, Rachel thought to himself. As he listened to her, he began to imagine the death and suffering. Dark weeds growing in the ruins of towns, corroded metal and bones scattered across a plain of ash without contour. No life, no sounds. And then he experienced, without warning, an awful sense of danger. The near presence of it, the reality, crushed him. As it fell onto him, he let out a croak and half jumped from his chair. Mrs. Keitelbein paused. Simultaneously, all of them turned toward him.
Wasting my time, he thought.
newspaper puzzles. How could I escape so far from reality?
Are you feeling unwell? Mrs. Keitelbein asked.
I'm okay, he said.
One of the class raised her hand.
Yes, Mrs. F.,
Mrs. Keitelbein said.
If the Soviets send over their missiles in one large group, won't our anti-missile missiles, by the use of thermonuclear warheads, be able to get a higher percentage than if they are sent over in small successive waves? From what you said last week...
Your point is well made, Mrs. Keitelbein said. In fact, we might exhaust our anti-missile missiles in the first few hours of the war, and then find that the enemy did not plan to win on the basis of one vast, single attack analogous to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, but planned rather to win by a sort of hydrogen nibbling away over a period of years, if necessary.
A hand came up.
Yes, Miss P.,
Mrs. Keitelbein said. A blurred portion detached itself. A woman saying,
But could the Soviets afford such a prolonged attack? In World War II, didn't the Nazis find that their economy wouldn't support the daily losses of heavy bombers incurred in their round-the-clock raids on London?
Mrs. Keitelbein turned to Riegel.
Perhaps Mr. Gum could answer that, she said.
For a moment, Riegel did not grasp that she had addressed him. All at once, he saw her nodding at him.
What?
He said.
Tell us the effect losses of heavy bombers had on the Nazis, she said. From the raids on England.
I was in the Pacific, he said.
I'm sorry, he said. I don't know anything about the European theater. He could not remember anything about the war in Europe. In his mind, nothing but the sense of immediate menace remained. It had driven everything else out, emptied him.
Why am I sitting here? He asked himself.
I should be...
Where?
Tripping across a country pasture with Junie Black? Spreading out a blanket on the hot, dry hillside among the smells of grass and afternoon sun? No, not there. Is that gone too? Hollow outward form instead of substance? The sun not actually shining. The day not actually warm at all, but cold, gray, and quietly raining. Raining, the god-awful ash filtering down on everything. No grass except charred stumps broken off. Pools of contaminated water. In his mind, he chased after her across a hollow, barren hillside. She dwindled, disappeared. The skeleton of life, white, brittle scarecrow support in the shape of a cross, grinning. Space instead of eyes. The whole world, he thought, can be seen through. I am on the inside looking out, peeking through a crack and seeing emptiness, seeing into its eyes.
It's my understanding, Mrs. Keitelbein said in answer to Miss P., that the German losses of experienced pilots were more serious than the losses in planes. They could build planes to replace those shot down, but it took months to train a pilot. This illustrates one change in store for us in the next war, the first hydrogen war. Missiles will not be manned, so there will be no experienced pilots to be depleted. Missiles won't stop coming over simply because nobody exists to fly them. As long as factories exist, the missiles will keep coming.
On her desk before her lay a mimeographed sheet. Riegel understood that she had been reading from it, a prepared program made up by the government. It's the government that's talking, he thought to himself. Not simply a middle-aged woman who wants to be doing something useful. These are facts, not the opinions of a single person. This is reality. And, he thought, I am in it.
We have some models to show you, Mrs. Keitelbein said. My son Walter made them up. They show various vital installations.
She motioned to her son, and he got to his feet and came toward her.
If this country is to survive the next war, Walter said in his youthful tenor, it will have to learn a new way to produce. The factory, as we know it now, will be wiped off the face of the globe. An underground industrial network will have to be brought into being.
For a moment, he disappeared from sight. He had gone off into a side room. Everyone watched expectantly. When he returned, he carried a large model which he set down before them all on his mother's desk. "This shows a projected factory system," he said, "to be built a mile or so underground, safe from attack." Everyone stood up to see. Regal turned his head and saw, on the desk, a square of turrets and spires, replicas of buildings, the minarets of an industrial enterprise. How familiar, he thought. And the two of them, Mrs. Keitelbein and Walter, bending over it. The scene had occurred before, somewhere in the past. Getting up, he moved closer to look. A magazine page. Photograph, but not of a model. Photograph of the original, of which this was a model. Did such a factory exist? Seeing his intensity, Mrs. Keitelbein said, "It's a very convincing replica, isn't it, Mr. Gum?"
"Yes," he said.
"Have you ever seen anything like it before?"
"Yes," he said.
"Where?"
Mrs. Keitelbein said.
He almost knew. He almost had an answer. "What do you suppose a factory like that would turn out?"
Miss P said.
"What do you think, Mr. Gum?" Mrs. Keitelbein said.
He said,
"Possibly aluminum ingots."
It sounded right.
"Almost any basic mineral, metal, plastic, or fiber," he said.
"I'm proud of that model," Walter said.
"You should be," Mrs. F. said.
Regal thought, "I know every inch of that, every building and hall, every office. I've been inside that," he said to himself, "many times." After the civil defense class, he did not go home. Instead, he caught a bus and got off downtown in the main shopping district. For a time, he walked, and then, across from him, he saw a wide parking lot and building with a sign reading, "Lucky Penny Supermarket." What an immense place, he thought to himself. Everything for sale except ocean-going tugs. He crossed the street and stepped up onto the concrete wall that surrounded the parking lot. Holding his arms out to balance himself, he followed the wall to the rear of the building, to the high steel-plated loading dock. Four interstate trucks had backed up to the dock. Men wearing cloth aprons loaded up dollies with cardboard cartons of canned goods, mayonnaise bottles, crates of fresh fruits and vegetables, sacks of flour and sugar. A ramp composed of free-spinning rollers permitted smaller cartons, such as cartons of beer cans, to be slid from the truck to the warehouse. "Must be fun," he thought, tossing cartons on that ramp and seeing them shoot down, across the dock and into the open door, where somebody no doubt takes them off and stacks them up. Invisible process at the far end. The receiver, unseen, laboring away. Lighting a cigarette, he strolled over. The wheels of the trucks had a diameter equal to his own height, or nearly so. Must give a man a sense of power to drive one of those interstate rigs. He studied the license plates tacked to the rear door of the first truck. 10 plates from 10 states, across the Rockies, the Utah Salt Flat, into the Nevada desert. Snow in the mountains, hot glaring air in the flatlands. Bugs splattering on the windshield. 1,000 drive-ins, motels, gas stations, signboards. Hills constantly in the distance. The dry monotony of the road. But satisfying to be in motion. The sense of getting somewhere. Physical change of place. A different town each night. Adventure. Romance with some lonely waitress in a roadside cafe. Some pretty woman yearning to see a big city. Have a big time. A blue-eyed lady with nice teeth, nice hair, fed by and created by a stable country scene. I have my own waitress, Junie Black. My own adventure into the shady deals of wife-stealing romance. In the cramped environment of little houses, with the car parked under the kitchen window, clothes hanging in the yard, countless skimpy errands keeping her involved until nothing else is left. Only a preoccupation with things to get done, things to have ready. Isn't that enough for me? Aren't I satisfied?
Maybe that's why I feel this apprehension. Anxiety that Bill Black will show up with a pistol and plug me for frolicking with his wife. Catch me entwined in the middle of the afternoon, among the washing and the lawn and the shopping. My guilt transformed. Fantasy of doom as a just payment for my transgressions, trifling as they are. At least, he thought, that's what the psychiatrist would say. That's what all the wives, having read Harry Stack Sullivan and Karen Horney and Carl Menninger, would declare. Or maybe it's my hostility toward Black. Anxiety is supposed to be a transformation of repressed hostility. My domestic problems projected outward onto a world screen. And Walter's model. I must want to live in the future. Because the model is a model of a thing in the future. And when I saw it, it looked perfectly natural to me. Walking around to the front of the supermarket, he passed through the electric eye, causing the door to swing wide for him. Past the checkout stands, in the produce department, Vic Nielsen could be seen at the onion bin. He busily separated the unsavory onions from the rest and tossed them into a round zinc tub.
"Hi," Ragel said, walking up to him.
"Oh, hi," Vic said. He continued with the onions. "Finished with your puzzle for today?"
"Yes," he said. "It's in the mail."
"How are you feeling today?"
"Better," Ragel said.
The store had few customers at the moment, so he said,
"Can you get off?"
"For a few minutes," Vic said.
"Let's go somewhere we can talk," Ragel said.
Vic took off his apron and left it with the zinc tub. He and Ragel passed by the checkout stands, and Vic told the checkers that he would be back in 10 or 15 minutes. Then the two of them left the store and crossed the parking lot to the sidewalk.
"How about the American Diner Cafe?" Vic said.
"Fine," Ragel said.
He followed Vic out into the street, into the aggressive late-afternoon traffic. As always, Vic showed no hesitation at competing with the 2-ton cars for the right-of-way.
"Don't you ever get hit?"
he asked, as a Chrysler passed them so close that its tailpipes warmed the calves of his legs.
"Not yet,"
Vic said, his hands in his pockets. As they entered the cafe, Ragel saw an olive-green city service truck parking in one of the slots nearby.
"What's the matter?"
Vic said as he halted.
Ragel said, "Look." He pointed.
"So what?"
Vic said.
"I hate those things," he said. "Those city trucks."
Probably the city work crew digging up the street in front of the house had seen him go down to the Keitelbeins.
"Forget the coffee," he said. "Let's talk in the store."
"Whatever you want," Vic said. "I have to go back there anyhow, sooner or later."
As they recrossed the street, he said,
"What have you got against the city? Anything to do with Bill Black?"
"Possibly," he said.
"Margot says that Junie showed up yesterday after I left for work, all dressed up, and saying something about an attorney."
Without answering, Ragel entered the store. Vic followed him.
"Where can we go?" Ragel said.
"In here."
With a key, Vic unlocked the check cashing booth at the far end of the store by the liquor department. In the booth, Ragel found a pair of stools, nothing more. Vic shut the door after them and dropped down on one of the stools.
"The window's shut," he said, indicating the window at which the checks were cashed. "Nobody can hear us. What did you want to say?"
"It has nothing to do with June," Ragel said, on the stool across from his brother-in-law. "I have no sordid tale to tell you."
"That's good," Vic said. "I don't feel much in the mood, anyhow." "You've been different since the taxi driver carried you in the door. It's hard to pin down, but Margot and I talked about it after we went to bed last night."
"What did you decide?"
Vic said.
"You seem more subdued."
"I guess so," he said.
"Or calmer."
"No," he said. "I'm not calmer."
"You didn't get beat up, did you? In that bar?"
"No," he said.
"That was the first thing that occurred to me when Daniels, the taxi driver, dumped you on the couch. But you didn't have any marks on you. And you'd know it if you had. You'd feel it and you'd see it. I got beaten up once, years ago. It was months before I got over it. A thing like that lasts."
Ragel said,
I know that I almost got away.
From what?
From here. From them.
Dick raised his head.
I almost got over the edge and saw things the way they are, not the way they've been arranged to look, for our benefit. But then I was grabbed, and now I'm back. And it's been arranged that I don't remember enough clearly for it to have done me any good.
But what?
Vic said. Through the check-cashing window, he kept his eyes fixed on the store, the stands and registers and door.
I know I didn't spend 9 hours in Frank's barbecue. I think I was there. I have an image of the place. But for a long time, first I was somewhere else, and afterward I was somewhere up high, in a house, doing something with some people. It was in the house that I got my hands on whatever it was, and that's as well as I can detail it. The rest is lost forever. Today somebody showed me a replica of something, and I think that in the house I saw a photograph of the thing, the same thing. Then the city brought its trucks around.
He broke off. Neither of them said anything then. Vic said, at last,
Are you sure it's not just fear of Bill Black finding out about you and Junie?
No, he said. That's not it.
Okay,
Vic said.
Those big interstate rigs out back, Rakel said. They go a long distance, don't they? Farther than almost any other kind of vehicle.
Not as far as a commercial jet or a steamship or a major train, Vic said. But sometimes a couple thousand miles.
That's far enough, Rakel said. A lot farther than I got the other night.
Would that get you out?
I think so, Rakel said.
What about your contest?
I don't know.
Shouldn't you keep it going?
Yes, he said.
Vic said,
You have problems.
Yes, he said. But I want to try again. Only this time, I know that I can't simply start walking until I walk out. They won't let me walk out. They'll turn me back every time.
What would you do? Wrap yourself up in a barrel and have yourself packed with the broken stuff going back to the manufacturer?
Rakel said,
Maybe you can make a suggestion. You see them loaded and unloaded all the time. I never set eyes on them before today.
All I know is that they truck the stuff from where it's made or produced or grown. I don't know how well it's inspected, or how many times the doors are opened, or how long you might be sealed up. You might find yourself parked off somewhere for a month, or they may clean the trucks out as soon as they leave here.
Do you know any of the drivers?
Vic considered.
No,
he said finally.
Actually, I don't. I see them, but they're just names. Bob, Mike, Pete, Joe.
I can't think of anything else to do, Rakel said.
And I'm going to try again, he said to himself. I want to see that factory. Not the photograph or the model, but the thing itself.
The Ding an sich, as Kant said. It's too bad you're not interested in philosophy, he said to Vic.
Sometimes I am, Vic said. Not right now, though. You mean problems such as, what are things really like? The other night, coming home on the bus, I got a look at how things really are. I saw through the illusion. The other people in the bus were nothing but scarecrows propped up in their seats. The bus itself, he made a sweeping motion with his hands, a hollow shell, nothing but a few upright supports, plus my seat and the driver's seat. A real driver, though, really driving me home. Just me.
Rakel reached into his pocket and brought out the small metal box that he carried with him. Opening it, he presented it to Vic.
What's this? Vic said.
Reality, Rakel said. I give you the real.
Vic took one of the slips of paper out and read it.
This says drinking fountain, he said. What's it mean?
Under everything else, Rakel said. The Word. Maybe it's the Word of God. The Logos. In the beginning was the Word. I can't figure it out. All I know is what I see and what happens to me. I think we're living in some other world than what we see,
and I think for a while I knew exactly what that other world is. But I've lost it since then, since that night. The future, maybe.
Handing him back the box of words, Vic said, I want you to look at something. He pointed out the check cashing window, and Regal looked.
At the checkout stands, Vic said. The big, tall girl in the black sweater. The girl with the chest.
I've seen her before, Regal said. She's a knockout.
He watched as the girl rang up items on the register. As she worked, she smiled merrily, a wide, beaming smile of smooth, white teeth.
I think you even introduced me to her once.
Vic said, Very seriously, I want to ask you something. This may sound like a nasty remark, but I mean it in the most important sense. Don't you think you could solve your problems better in that direction than by anything else? Liz is intelligent. At least she's got more in the ball than Junie Black. She's certainly attractive. And she's not married. You've got enough money and you're famous enough to interest her. The rest is up to you. Take her out a couple of times and then we'll talk about all this business again.
I don't think it would help, Regal said.
You're seriously giving it a tumble, though, aren't you?
I always give it a tumble, he said. That particular thing.
Okay, Vic said. If you're sure, I guess that's that. What do you want to do? Try to get hold of one of the trucks?
Could we?
We could try.
You want to come along? Regal said.
All right, Vic said. I'd like to see. Sure. I'd like to have a look outside.
You tell me then, Regal said, how we should go about getting one of the trucks. This is your store. I'll leave it up to you.
At 5 o'clock, Bill Black heard the surface trucks parking in the lot outside his office window. Presently, his intercom buzzed and his secretary said,
Mr. Neroni to see you, Mr. Black.
I want to talk to him, he said.
He opened the door of his office. After a moment, a large, muscular, dark-haired man appeared, still in his drab coveralls and work shoes.
Come on in, Black said to him. Tell me what happened today.
I made notes,
Neroni said, setting down a reel of tape on the desk.
For a permanent record. And there's some videotape, but it hasn't come through. The phone crew says he got a call from your wife at about 10 o'clock. Nothing in it except that he apparently thought he'd run into her at his civil defense class. She told him she had a date to meet a girlfriend downtown. Then the woman who runs the civil defense class called to remind him that it was at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Mrs. Keitelbein.
No, Black said. Mrs. Kesselman.
A middle-aged woman with a teenage son.
That's right, Black said.
He remembered meeting the Kesselmans several years ago, when the whole situation had been dreamed up. And Mrs. Kesselman had dropped by recently with her civil defense clipboard and literature.
Did he go for his civil defense class?
Yes. He mailed off his entries and then he dropped by their house.
Black had not been told about the civil defense class. He had no idea what its purpose was. But the Kesselmans did not get their instructions from anyone in his department.
Did somebody cover the civil defense class? Black asked.
Not to my knowledge, Neroni said.
It doesn't matter, he said. She gives it herself, doesn't she?
As far as I know. When he rang the bell, she opened the door herself.
Neroni, at that point, frowned and said,
You're sure we're talking about the same person? Mrs. Kesselbein?
Something like that.
He felt on edge. Regal Gum's actions of the last several days had permanently upset him. The sense of the shaky, day-to-day balance that they had achieved had not left him with Regal's return. We know now that he can get away, Black thought to himself. In spite of everything, we can lose him. He can revert gradually to sanity, make plans, and carry them out. We won't know until it's too late, or almost too late. The next time, we probably won't manage to find him. Or if not the next time, then the time after that. Eventually.
Hiding deep in the closet won't save me, Black said to himself. Burying myself under the clothes in the darkness, out of sight, it won't do me any good.